Welcome everyone to the podcast. Today's episode is an invited talk that I gave at Stanford in the summer of 2019. I was invited to speak to a group of undergraduates who were doing research over the summer by a former intern, Peter Phan, who is now a PhD student at Stanford, and he should be finishing up in a few years. Peter asked me to talk about anything I wanted, and so I decided to depart from the regular technical discussions about mixers and RF products and things like that, and instead focus on pieces of advice that I would give to young engineers coming out of school. Specifically, I told several stories about things I learned from my mentors while coming up in my early 20s that I think every engineer could use. So without further ado, we hope you enjoy.
Morning, everybody. How y'all doing today?
Go
Bears. So I'd like to introduce you to Chris Markey. So I know Chris because I did an internship at his company right after I graduated from Berkeley. And I have to say it was one of the best experiences I had in my life. Like, you know, Chris taught me how to take microwave component measurements, how to use tools, how to take a good measurement, how to be a good engineer. And very strangely and uniquely, I don't think helped his experience again. You know, he was always around doing technical work with the engineers. It was great. And despite all this, he thinks op amps are hard. So today, Chris will be presenting on some lessons he's learned in his life, and hopefully this information is useful to you as you consider your engineering careers. All right, take it away, Chris.
Thanks, Peter. Well, thanks for coming. I guess you actually were forced to come here by, like, legal right. So I guess thanks for being part of the program that forced you to be here. I knew Peter, since 3 years ago? So what he just told you is kind of a lie now. I don't spend that much time anymore with the younger engineers on a day-to-day basis. Things have gotten very crazy at the company. And what I'm about to tell you, let's say our life lessons that I've come across through my trials and tribulations as an engineer, as I've pivoted from being an undergrad to a grad student in optics, to then going from optics to microwave, then to going from, I guess, being a microwave designer to being like a CEO of a microwave company. So I did a dry run of this talk yesterday with our younger engineers, and it went reasonably well. I need to start with a few caveats regarding this talk. First off, we're a hardware company. We're not a software company. We're not a CMOS company. We're a niche microwave and RF business, meaning that we primarily do analog RF ICs or RF components specifically. And so we're really like in the far. We're in the long tail of a large distribution within the electronics industry. And so my perspective is quite unique, I guess, and probably not consistent with other people in the world. So I'm going to make a lot of generalized statements. There's always going to be an exception to what I say. The other thing I'll say is that I'm describing my experience going from, I guess, undergrad through to what I'm doing today. And some of the things you'll resonate with, some of the things you won't. But hopefully you'll take something out of it. So a little bit about my background. I was born and raised in the Bay Area. I went to Bellarmine, graduated in 92. I wanted to go to Stanford, was rejected, so I went to Duke. And then I graduated from Duke with a BSEE in 2002. And then I wanted to go to Stanford for grad school, and they rejected me again. So I have a huge chip on my shoulder for being here right now, but I feel like this is comeuppance, because I was invited to talk at Stanford finally. So I went to UCSD for graduate. Originally, I didn't want to get a PhD. And I could talk about that maybe at the end of the talk as to why I didn't want a PhD. But I did eventually go and it was recruited by Sadek Esner to go there to get a PhD in optics. And so after that, I got very sick and tired of research and academics by my fifth year. And I wanted to do something a lot more practical with my, I guess, abilities. And so I went and worked with my dad at Markey Microwave, which was founded in 1991. I'll give a brief background in a second about Markey. My notable career achievements are, I have various notable things I'm proud of. I'm not here to talk about me necessarily. I want to talk about my development. The things that I think are interesting about me is that when I was your age, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. In fact, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in my career from about the time that I was a teenager and realized I wasn't going to be a professional soccer player until about the time I was 25. So there's a good 10-year period there where I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And that's totally okay. I think that there's a pressure when you're in undergrad to know, like, oh, this is the specialty I want to take and all these things. That's BS. Most people, I don't think, know what they want to do, even when they're 22, 23, 25. You'll eventually find something you like. So what's interesting about that for me, I guess, is that I've actually transitioned several times, really, from doing focusing on optics to then focusing on RF and microwave to then focusing on, I guess, business development and advanced product development, if you will. You will, with the techniques that you develop over your life, you'll be able to do that. And I would expect that people, you know, graduating from Stanford would have that kind of career arc. So I'm going to explain a couple things that they won't teach you when you're an undergrad. Okay, Markey Microwave, what are we? We are a broadband high-frequency RF and microwave component company. We build electronics, we design them and manufacture them in our one facility in Morgan Hill, so South Bay, which is kind of an insane thing, which I'll talk about at the very end of this talk. Most of you probably wouldn't have guessed that there's a fast-growing company who builds their own stuff in the Bay Area. That's very atypical these days. And frankly, it is getting harder and harder to maintain a business in this area when you do manufacturing. We specialize in what's called gallium arsenide MMIC. Who knows what that is? Anybody know what MMIC is? Besides Peter? Okay. So a MMIC is a type of IC. It stands for monolithic microwave integrated circuit. So it's an integrated circuit that achieves some kind of microwave frequency processing. So things like mixers, amplifiers, switches, filters. Those would be called MMIC if they're built on an IC platform. So we do those. We also do what's called hybrid circuit. Who knows what a microwave hybrid circuit is? Okay. Microwave hybrid circuits are the same kinds of things I just described, but they're not built on a monolithic IC platform. So they wouldn't be a silicon filter. It would be like an FR4 filter, or it would be an FR4 board, a PC board, with soldered components on top to make a low frequency filter or amplifier. So things you can buy from DigiKey. You guys know what DigiKey is? So you can buy these components and you can build these hybrid, what's called a hybrid circuit. Who here has actually taken RF or microwave as a course? Man, they don't teach this stuff anymore, Peter. We're in trouble. This is not going to resonate well. Okay, so if you ever take it, it's a fun class, and you learn about how, like, the physical size of the circuits you're trying to manufacture. Oh, let me take one step backwards. What is microwave? Microwave is the field of electronics where the circuits that you're building are roughly the same size as the wavelengths of the electromagnetic waves they are processing. Does that make sense? So as you go to higher frequency, the wavelength gets much shorter, and so the chips become along the same order of magnitude as the waves themselves. And when that happens, a lot of weird stuff happens. And that's why it's a specialty field that you pretty much do your entire life in. You don't really do microwave and CMOS design, generally speaking. You will diverge fairly early on in your career. And there are not a lot of people that can do MMIC design that also would do, let's say, digital CMOS design. Yep.
What's the general frequency spectrum?
Okay, good question. RF and microwave is usually considered something like hundreds of megahertz through what's called millimeter wave. Millimeter wave would be millimeter wave, I think it's like something like 30 gigahertz. but it goes beyond that. So we produce product that work really from DC through 110 gigahertz. And you see a lot of things like 5G, you know, in the marketing of various big tech companies. There's a big war right now going on with like Huawei and the US and Qualcomm and all these companies. Apple's far behind is what the news headlines are saying. 5G is a big deal, and they're going to be operating at millimeter wave frequencies. So it's good for us because the industry is kind of coming towards what we know. But anyway, so that's where we focus on. Some stats about the company. We were formed in 1991 by my parents. Since I've joined, we've grown about 5x in sales, and the physical, you know, the employee count is up to about 125. I started when there was about 40. And we do everything in-house, and most of what we do is what I would call trade secret. We don't patent, and I could talk about that as well if you guys want to talk about patents, but I'm pretty staunchly opposed to patents. I think they're a bad idea, especially when you're a small company, and we choose not to file them for that reason. In terms of the products, we make amplifiers, things called balance, bias tees, couplers, and we're very well known for what's called a mixer. Let's talk about that at the end. Yeah, I could speak for an hour on why I don't like patents. Okay, so what do? Well, I started out in my schooling, much like you guys, is you're mostly learning how to do product design. So you're learning how to operate various forms of software and do MATLAB scripting or whatever to do design, and you're doing ADS maybe for simulations or SPICE or something like that. And that's what your life is when you're an undergrad, and then problem sets. So that's what I was taught to do, and that's what I did for a while within my career. But over time, I had to do a lot more than that. And so one of the things I want to make clear to you guys today is what you do today and what you're taught today probably won't be what you do when you get out into the real world. And there's a lot of other areas of engineering and electrical engineering that are interesting and useful. Some of those would be product engineering. And what I mean by that is once the product is actually designed and you have it, you have to characterize it, you have to test it, you have to beat it up, you have to do things like reliability testing. You have to design the factory to be able to manufacture the product at high volume and test it at high volume potentially. You have to do application support, so you have to talk to customers, you have to talk to some of the best minds in the world about how to use your product and teach them how to use it. Then you have to work with them on what's wrong with your product to decide what you can make better about it. And that's what people would think of as business development. So all of those items are, the foundation is your technical ability. The better you are technically, the more you can do whatever you want within those various areas. And then for me, I eventually had to do other things. So I had to worry about marketing. I had to worry about 10 years out, if we were going to be obsolete because of some disruption, and technology disruption. I had to learn how to mentor young people like Peter, although he doesn't really need much mentoring. And I had to, even harder than that, I had to learn how to mentor people who were not engineers. And that's something that I never would have thought was going to be one of the hardest things for me to do, but it's If you advance in your career, you will eventually probably be the boss of somebody who has no technical background whatsoever. And that's not easy. At least it wasn't easy for me. And I can describe that maybe towards the end. So, yeah. Well, for me, I'll answer that very briefly, and then we can talk about that at the end, maybe in some Q&A. For me, the most rewarding thing has always been and remains to this day, dreaming up a product idea or a circuit concept that turns out to be true, that I don't think anybody has done before, and then exploiting it to build something that I can sell. The act of thinking of it, building it, and then getting that first order for me is better than the money. It's always been better than the money. There's I'll tie into to a little backstory later, but I'll describe that in a little bit. But that's me. There's plenty of people who find other things. I've met people in interviews who tell me they'll be interviewing for like a management position, and I'll say, tell me about, you know, what's the most rewarding thing about your job? So the same thing you just asked me, and they'll say, I love making other people successful. And I think that's like the most noble thing, and I've never felt that way, like, to be honest. It was never a guiding motivation. Let's just put it that way. So there's altruistic reasons, there's selfish reasons like mine. But I like to be inventive. I guess that's my main thing. Okay, so whenever I interview people and I say, what do you want to do in your career? They say, I want to design. Almost always. I would say 95% of the undergrads that we interview, they say, I want to design because I want to apply what I've done in my undergrad towards, I just want to continue it. I want to get better and I want to be able to design product. And I sit down and I have to explain to them the following. You're not going to do that unless you pretty much pay your dues one way or the other. You have no idea what you don't know. And probably nobody's going to give you a chance unless you're like a super duper all-star. And the reason I do that up front, it's kind of a weird recruiting technique, I guess, is I'm actually trying to filter out the people who have completely delusional ideas. It's not common for an undergrad to go into a job where they're going to have some autonomous role in doing design work. Now, what do I mean? I should probably define design before I get too carried away. I'm defining design in the context of what most hardware engineering people would think of, which is typically in an integrated circuit development of some kind. Most of the hardware electronics out there and most of your schooling would be on like CMOS and BJTs and FETs, that kind of design work, if you're doing circuit level. I'm not talking about software development. I don't know software development, so there's my caveat right there. Although I would imagine there are analogous sort of rules that I'm following here. But within the context of IC design flow, it goes something like this. You have a product you want to make. There's some specs that are nebulously defined. And I do mean nebulous. Like, the specs themselves, people tend to think of as being hard. Like, you know, my professor gave me a design to design an op amp with a certain amount of gain or something like that. And I had to prove that it has it's unconditionally stable, like on paper. Nobody actually does that in real life. Typically, it's like a bunch of people in a room yelling at each other as to what the specs should be because the customer needs a particular metric. So even that's a moving target when you're designing. Eventually, it flows down into the software space where everybody's designing circuit level or even layout level. So they're aligning the transistors on the chip. And then it goes down to design verification, then it gets fabbed at some foundry. It comes back, you have a chip, okay, good, it works. And then you put it in a package and you ship it and you sell it. Well, the problem with that is how products are developed. That's how we develop products. But the majority of the work when it comes to product, I guess, technology development and product development, which is where I assume most of you want to be involved in, most of the work is after the thing is built. You have to verify it works. You have to make data sheets. You have to make instruction manuals for the people to use your part, especially when it's a digital chip. I mean, you should see digital data sheets. Digital chip data sheets are like Bibles. They're like 100 pages. If you go get a high-end A to D converter from Analog Devices, it's ridiculously long. I don't know how many app engineers must work on that, but it's got to be a month of work for like at least 5 people. So, I mean, there's a substantial amount of work just for like one particular product. And so in the end, a lot of the work ends up being in things your school doesn't teach you. So those things will be like packaging, reliability, and manufacturability. So most of the people that go into industry, that's what they're working on. They're not working on design as we've defined it in this slide. So that's kind of where I was when I started. I thought I was going to do design, and I realized very quickly I wasn't. So here's a snapshot of who I was when I was 21 and graduating from college. I had a good work ethic. I was really good and fast at learning. I had a good GPA. I was very good at doing bounded problems, meaning problem sets, finals, things with schedules, things with objective answers. What is the gain? It's going to calculate to be this. Okay, I could do that. I was good at gaming the grading system. I mean, Stanford, I think, is relatively famous for grade inflation, right, Peter? So you got, and he went to Berkeley, so I mean, he's the authority on this because they don't have that. The game was to get a good grade. That was my job. It wasn't to learn, it was to get a good grade. At least that's how I thought about the problem. And I was good at that. You know, how many of you have had the experience where you're in a lecture and then somebody raises their hand and they say, "Professor, will that be on the exam?" Yeah. And then he says, "No, this is just for your own edification." And you stop taking notes. That's exactly my mentality when I was in college. And frankly, it kind of still is today. You can only remember so much stuff. But I was into the objective side of being good at engineering. I had basic tools. I was good at math, I was good at science, and I was good at reasonably okay-ish at software. And I was a good writer. So that was maybe something that is not often talked about when you're talking to engineers, but know how to write, please. Like, know how to communicate through email properly, be clear. That's something, if you are good at writing as an engineer, you will be better off than about 3/4 of your peers. And I don't say that because I think that people are bad writers. It's just that it's not a focus, and it should be. You should get good at writing. But I had a lot of drawbacks. So those are the good things about me. And you guys are all, you probably share some of those features. But there are a lot of bad things about me. First of all, I had a really high ego. I thought I was graduating from a good school. I thought that I was very smart. I thought that, the world was my oyster. And I thought that people would respect me for where I graduated with a high GPA. Turns out that was really wrong. And then I found out that I knew almost nothing, especially when I went to grad school. So I had no breadth of knowledge, I had no depth of knowledge, I had no experience in what I call unbounded problems. So unbounded problems would be the opposite of a problem set. An unbounded problem is something like parenting. Trying to be a good parent, and the problems you face I have a 10-month-old. There's no right or wrong to most of what I do. It's just a continuous gradient of, good and less good things to do. And that's actually how the real world tends to work, in my experience. Most of the hardest, most important problems you guys are going to solve are not defined when you start working on them. And that can be terrifying, especially when you're in grad school, because part of the PhD process, really, in my view, is to take on an unbounded problem, put boundaries around it, solve it, write some papers, and graduate. That's what the PhD should be. And hopefully your professor doesn't tell you what to do. And that's the biggest mistake professors make, is when they give their students problems. It's good to let them suffer. My advisor made me suffer, and I'll explain that in a moment. I disliked subjective scoring. I despised non-technical expertise. I became an engineer because I thought it was the most noble thing one could do. If you weren't a STEM major, I thought you were a moron. That was kind of my attitude. Oh, look at all those econ majors partying on Thursday night. I couldn't do that. I was going down to the engineering library to work on a problem set. So I had a totally biased technical attitude that I thought technical ability was the number one thing. I'm here to tell you now, it's definitely not true once you get out there. So basically, I wasn't qualified to do engineering work. I wasn't qualified to do design and innovation. I was qualified to solve engineering problems, and they're totally different things. So I want to talk about what I had to do to, shore up my weaknesses and get to the point where I could make my own decisions and start to actually design my own product and, pivot my career in various ways. Okay, so I did go to grad school. We can talk about that maybe at the end, as to why I did, but I chose to go to grad school because I wanted to study optics. I was interested in fiber optics and high-speed communication. I went post first internet bubble crash. So that was probably the worst time to go and learn fiber optics because it was like a dead zone for about 10 years there. But I went and I studied it. And there were three major turning points for me that I want to talk about today. And they were life lessons that to this day I think about. The first one happened around my third year, and it is this concept that I wasn't thinking deeply enough. And it was this was pointed out to me by my quasi-advisor, Professor Roddick. I say quasi because he was, for all intents and purposes, he was my advisor, and I spent most of my technical life in grad school with him, but he was only on my committee. My actual advisor was a guy named Professor Sadek Esner, who gave me probably the worst butt whooping I ever had in terms of like technical spanking. And that's the second life lesson that I learned, and it's that your first slide is the most important slide. I'll explain that story in a moment. And then the last lesson I learned, which is sort of a continuous lesson that I always learned from my dad, which is that you have to learn how to call your own bluff if you want to make, you know, progress in your career. So each one of these lessons has mostly a story behind it, so I'll tell the stories. When I was a third year, starting out my third year, I had just completed my master's exam, so that I got my MSEE after 2 years. There was a qualifying exam, and really what that did is it qualified you to continue to stay at UCSD and do PhD level work. My advisor was a staunch opponent of giving students problems to solve. He wanted the student to come up with the problem, pitch him on the idea, and then you work on it as your thesis, which is crazy hard to do when you don't really know what you're doing. And so I ended up befriending Professor Stoyan Roddick, who had just, he was new to UCSD, he had come from Bell Labs. Anybody know what Bell Labs is? Bell Labs is a pretty high-end research company. I guess, who are they, Alcatel-Lucent now? I don't even know all the stuff, but anyway, you can actually, like, I've actually been to the Bell Labs site where they did like the original radio astronomy telescope that discovered background radiation. It's still there. So you're talking about some of the brightest minds to ever work in the field of engineering and science. They worked out of this building. So Stoyan was from there. So he was he was the most technically gifted professor I had really come across, in my view. And he was extremely good at experiments, and he had a great lab, so he invited me into the lab because he had no students at the time, and I went to Duke, and he had actually spent some time at Duke, so I guess we had a camaraderie there. So he said, yeah, Chris, you can, you know, work in the lab and do some of these experiments that he had really designed the experiments for me. I didn't know what I was doing originally. But I spent the first 6 months of my third year developing a test bed that would automate these tests called bit error rate or bit error ratio tests. And what a bit error ratio test is you send data down the pipe, and then you measure the data, and you compare how many errors in the ones and zeros you get at the end versus what you sent. So you compare the receiver with the transmitter, and you get a ratio. That ratio determines the fidelity of your transmission. Makes sense? Easy enough. And I had this really elaborate setup because I was measuring the impact of certain types of noise on the receiver. It was good scientific work. I mean, it was really just an extension of work he had done at Bell Labs, but that was fine. It was a really good experience. I learned a lot about how to do experiments. And I learned how to do GPI programming in LabVIEW. Anybody use LabVIEW before? Heard of it? Okay, LabVIEW is like it's like an operating system for your lab. So you can like control the synthesizer and control the power supply, and you can just automate it all. So you can sit there and drink coffee while you're actually doing work, quote unquote. So one day, and I had it up and running. I was taking data for my first paper. I was very proud of myself. So one day, Professor Roddick walks in with another guy named Professor Peter Andrickson. Peter Andrickson is an extremely famous professor from Chalmers in the optics field. And he and Stoyan were buddies. So Stoyan was very proud of his lab, and he's showing it, you know, to everybody. And he takes Peter over to me, and he says, Chris, this is Professor Andrickson. Can you show him your setup? It's pretty cool what you've done. So I'm very proud of it. I'm showing Professor Andrickson my thing. He's like, hey, let's run it. Show me the plots. So I hit run. You know, about 2 minutes later, it plops up this result. And the result looked like what you see in the red. And it has this dip, and then it comes back up. And Peter looks at it, and he goes, what do you think of that? I say, what do you mean? I'm like, that's the result. He's like, oh, are you sure? Yeah, I've been working on this for like 6 months. Like, all of my plots look like that. I'm gonna publish this. And he goes, okay, nice to meet you, and he walks out. So later that day, I go and talk to Stoyan. Peter had left, and they had this conversation right after he talked to me, which was something like this. Stoyan, your student is an idiot. He has no idea what he's doing. He's not thinking deeply about the problem he's actually trying to solve. So when I go to talk to Stoyan, he goes, you're embarrassing me. What did you say to him? And I explained to him, and he looks, and I showed him my data, and he goes, he's just shaking his head. He's like, you need to think about this. So what happened? Well, the error was this. I showed a plot that indicated to Professor Andrickson that with more noise, I could actually make the part work better up until a point at which when I injected even more noise, or sorry, I have to get this right. I demonstrated that I would have more errors with less noise. That's what the upper right area shows. And then the null is that I have actually fewer areas with a moderate amount of noise. So there was an optimized position where noise was good. That's how you would have interpreted this. And Peter's shaking his head like, you either invented great physics or you're an idiot. And the truth is I was an idiot. So I happened to find, in preparing for this, I found this blurb from Peter Andrickson's current website, and it says this. He has served on several technical program committees, including OFC, ECOC, and as international research panel member, and has also twice served as an expert for the evaluation of the Nobel Prize in Physics. Boy, that was like, I read that, I was like, wow, now I feel even worse about what happened. I mean, I looked like such an amateur. I was embarrassed. Professor Roddick was embarrassed, although he probably doesn't remember this story at all. But man, it never left me that feeling of complete inadequacy. And so obviously I went home and I thought about what I had done. And the answer was very quick. I realized within probably 20 minutes the error. But the error was simple, and I'll explain it to you because this is a science lecture, right? So in optics, there's when you measure noise in the receiver, you're measuring many types of noise that add up to cause errors in your decision as to whether you've sent a one or a zero. And there's this noise called signal spontaneous beat noise. And signal spontaneous beat noise is proportional to the power in the one, the power in the what they call the mark, which means that if you send a low power and a high power to represent ones and zeros, the low power has a smaller signal spontaneous beat noise than the large power. So you get this walk-off where ones contain much more noise than zeros, and that's what I'm showing in the below eye diagram. You see that it gets all fuzzy in the one, and it stays reasonably compressed in the zero. What that does is it means that when you're automating your test setup, you have to have a variable decision threshold that goes down as you increase the noise. And I realized what I had done. I was like, oh man, so this little null, all this null represented was if you fix the decision threshold at 50-50. But if I move the decision threshold down as I increase the noise, I can actually take that hump and push it more farther down into the mud to the point where I'll have no bit errors again. So I ended up correcting my automation algorithm, where I did a search for the optimal decision threshold. It took probably a week of retooling my lab view, but then after that, I had to retake 6 months worth of data to make my new plots. Those plots took way longer, by the way, because I had to search for the optimal threshold. I didn't know where it was going to be, so I had to take for every point, I would have to do about 10 measurements to find out which one was the local min. But I ended up finishing it. It did become the results of my first paper. The bottom right picture is what it's supposed to look like. So you should see this continual degradation, or this sort of downsloping of the line. And everything was good, and I didn't look like an idiot in front of professors anymore. And I was very proud of this. But this segues into the next important lesson. Let me step back. How have I used this lesson, this life lesson of being really embarrassed in front of a very smart person? Well, the lesson was this, that you need to think deeply about what you're working on. And it sounds like a trivial thing to say, but I'm telling you, in my experience of mentoring young engineers, every one of you guys will go through this, where you're gonna make an assumption about, let's say, the test setup you're using, and you're gonna assume the equipment's correct, and what's on the screen is what's on the screen, and then you're gonna ignore something like calibration. Well, you didn't calibrate the machine, so what you got is bogus. Or you didn't understand that there's a limitation in that particular measurement technique, which prevents you from doing the measurement you want to do in the first place. So that's what I mean by thinking deeply. You can't just assume that the results you got are correct. You always have to antagonize them. Because I promise you, especially if you go to grad school, you will get antagonized. Your committee will antagonize you. What your committee members do, they are professional, like, graph lookers. They're professionals at looking at figures and finding out what's wrong with the figure. The classic thing is when somebody shows an experimental plot versus a theoretical plot, and they're not the same. The first thing, they'll stop you mid-sentence, like, why is that not matching? And if you don't have a plausible explanation, you will not pass your exam. That's pretty much how PhD committees work. They don't even read the text, by the way. They only look at the pictures. They're like children. So it's not a bad thing. I mean, reading is boring sometimes. But how have I used this in my own career? Well, first of all, it did get me through grad school, because I started thinking much more critically about the work I was doing. And it led to what's an important concept called technical insight. Technical insight is the first time I ever heard it was from Eric Schmidt. Who knows who Eric Schmidt is? CEO of Google, right? So former CEO of Google. So Eric Schmidt wrote a book, and he described some of the principles that Google follows. And it's a good book. It's called How Google Works. I definitely took some inspiration from it. But one of the things he says is that all of the great Google products and services are based on some kind of deep technical insight that their competitors or other people had not yet understood. So that's the think deeply about the problem. And I applied that right when I came to Marky Microwave, because there's this concept in the RF and microwave space, and it's called RF black magic. Anybody heard of that before? Probably not. You guys aren't really RF people. They don't teach RF anymore, do they, Peter? Well, that's sad. Word of wisdom, go into a field nobody wants to go to. Run away from the crowd. Like, seriously. It will serve you very well. So get into RF. But there's this concept of RF black magic. And what RF black magic is the hand-wavy method that lazy engineers use to explain that they cannot know how something behaves, it just does it. So the way that it happens, the reason it happens in RF is that you could have two identical parts. And all, you won't be able to visually determine that they're different. They will look identical. The circuits will look the same. One will work, one will not work. Or one will work really well, one will not work really well. And so lazy RF people wave their hands and they say, it's an unknowable thing. That's just the black magic of RF. And one of the other reasons I think it's called black magic is that it's kind of like the dark arts, where certain wizards are really good at manipulating it. Like, my dad is a classic RF graybeard. He can just look at things. He'll look at the screen, look at the measurement, look at your setup, and he'll go, boop, and it'll work. It's weird. It feels like magic sometimes. And what he's done is he's developed intuition over the years, right? So he's just done it for like 50 years, so he knows the sweet spots of the problem. But people don't explain it. They don't articulate it with the theory. They don't show cause and effect. So when I started at Markey, I hated black magic explanations. And I had a lot of people in the company who would use it as an excuse to not know. It's an excuse for ignorance. So I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. Everything that we do here is knowable. We're going to find cause and effect. We're going to, you know, turn over all the different rocks. We're going to figure out what lever moves, which knob moves, you know, what light lights up on the screen. And over time, if you do that enough, you get to the point where you have things like first pass design success in IC tape outs, which to you guys may not be a big deal, but to me, it's a huge deal. It's at least $100,000 per run if I get it wrong. And it's at least 6 months of delay in getting a product out the door. So I start measuring things that, like, my life is now measured on the order of years because of how long it takes certain products to get, you know, to market. So losing 6 months is a big deal. So if you think deeply about what you're doing and you know all the little things, all the little knobs, and you use scientific rigor to prove them, it will do you a lot of justice. Okay, so the next lesson I learned is the one that hurt the most. So I had spent my third year developing my test bed. I took a lot of data. It was publishable data. And I went with this data to my advisor on my birthday in 2005. And if you're like most grad students, who wants to go to grad school, by the way? I'm just curious. Okay, so maybe half of you, maybe more than that. You won't see your advisor very often, probably. So Peter launched the talk with saying, oh, you know, I actually got to see Chris. Well, that is true. Like, your PhD advisor, it was true. your PhD advisor won't be that available to you, especially when you're early on, unless you're really lucky or you find somebody who's like a fresh, younger professor because they don't have as much to do. But I had like a tenured senior level advisor. So he was always like flying to DC to work on DARPA programs and stuff like that, or going to give invited talks somewhere. So they're just never around. I finally got him to sit down and look at my data after, like, you know, a full summer of not seeing him. And he looks at it because I sent him this big pile of data. I said, Sadek, look, I have all, like, I can publish this. He looks at it, he goes, this is crap. Why do I have to look at this? Everything you've done doesn't matter to me. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, can you explain to me, like, why you're doing this? Like, what's the motivation here? And I got indignant. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that I had this sort of righteous view of my technical abilities and that technical people were the best people in the world. And so I said to him, like, flat out, I'm not a marketing student. It doesn't matter what the background and motivation is. This is my work. This is my opus. I can publish this. We're gonna get rich, man. And he's like, ooh, you have a lot to learn, kid. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm an engineer. I'm not in marketing and sales. They're completely different things. And he says, they're not different things. If you want to be a leader in the technical field, and that's what you're here to get a PhD. PhD is not that you're a professional experimentalist. A PhD is that you know how to run your own scientific problem and explain it, especially in the engineering field where it's an applied science. It's not just science for science's sake. If human beings don't benefit from your work as an engineer, it's really not engineering. He says, if you want to get a PhD, you're going to have to learn how to lead. You're going to have to learn how to communicate the importance of your work to others so that you can convince them that it's useful. And I was beside myself. I was angry because he didn't even look at my results. He was lecturing me on what I consider to be marketing. And he just didn't get it. So I was angry. I left the room. I basically walked straight out to La Jolla Shores, and I sat for about 2 hours in the afternoon, pissed off, crying, angry. Like, who is this guy to tell me that my engineering career is about me communicating with other people about the fluffiness of how awesome the work is? Well, after the dust settled and I got over my anger, I kind of had to admit something, that he was right. I thought about the full year of work that I had done, and everything I had done with blinders on, just chugging away in lab, came to work, worked 14-hour days, went home and played Halo 2. Halo 2 was like the game then. Probably would have been Fortnite, I'm sure. But the point is that for the entire third year of my career, I didn't think about what I was doing. I was just chugging along. And so when he said, can you just explain to me one reason why this is interesting to anybody besides like you, Professor Roddick, and maybe like one dude at Bell Labs who would read the paper? And I was like, I couldn't do it. So that was a problem. So I eventually got over it. I eventually started to appreciate what he had told me, because it really was a pearl of wisdom. I think it's, of all the things I'm telling you today, this is the most important feature, I think, of what I can offer to you. You are not just engineers. You are engineers, especially from Stanford. I would expect you guys to use your talents and your opportunity that you've been given to be at one of the top, if not the top schools in the world, to do something useful with your ability. And that means that you're gonna have to lead people. That means that you're gonna have to help others understand why they're doing the work they're doing. People will buy in and follow you if you have a good motivation for the very hard technical challenges you're gonna face. But if you can't articulate it, forget it. I don't care how strong you are technically, you won't go very far. And you will get railroaded within your company too. Because if you can't at least politely talk to the CEO about why what you're doing matters, that CEO is not going to keep you around very long. So what are the lessons that I can teach you? Okay, so these are the things that I learned. First of all, the why of what you're doing is actually more important than the what you're doing. I have no doubt every single one of you could do any technical challenge that I could give you within my company. The second thing I learned, my boss is not lazy, he is busy. This is something that a lot of undergrads, well, a lot of grad students miss, and a lot of young engineers miss. Your boss doesn't think about you as much as you think. They're not like your parents, they're not like professors who are at office hours. They have their own job to do. They think about you to the reciprocal of the number of employees they manage. So if they have like six employees, they think about you less than 1/6 of the time. That's just the facts. So it's your job to present work to your boss in such a way that they'll get it and they don't have to spend a lot of wasted time trying to understand your convoluted explanations. Another thing I learned was that productivity is more important than your hours worked. It didn't matter that I was in lab for 12 hours a day. What mattered was the output that I got. And I know plenty, a good motivating factor for doing your work is laziness. It's okay if you don't want to work that hard, as long as you can get more done. Some of the best ideas I've ever had was because I was lazy. And I was like, man, if I just wrote like a MATLAB script, I could get this all done and I could go home. But the upfront will suck. I'll spend a month coding, but then for the rest of my life, I'll have this script and I can just, you know, hit go and I'll have new designs. So you should think about your life like that. Like, try to be lazy. That's a great way to innovate. So the first slide principle, this is something I teach all the people within my company. I learned this from Professor Esner and also another person that I did startup consulting with when I was in grad school. But here's the principle, and I suggest you follow this. First of all, always provide a summary and motivation on your first slide. That's why it's called the first slide theory. Most of your time should be spent on only the first few slides. If you're making like a PowerPoint of a report for somebody who's your senior or your senior senior or and so on. And the audience of that report is not your boss, it's your boss's boss. When you think of it that way, what you do is you distill down the information more and more and more. You say, God, is my boss's boss really gonna care about that particular nuanced argument about why the graph shoots up instead of down? No, he's not gonna care. They don't care about that kind of stuff. Give them the big picture. It also forces you to really think critically about why you're doing it in the first place, because you have to simultaneously give the contribution you've made and the motivation. It's not easy to do. That's why you spend most of your time on the first slide. Remember, pictures and figures are much more important than words. And if you ever publish like an IEEE paper or any kind of refereed article, you will spend more time on figures than anything else. The prose is almost irrelevant. You could put Mary had a little lamb in the paragraphs, I'm pretty convinced, in certain journals, but as long as the figures are good, you'll get published. And then remember, you put your details of your work in like the body of a presentation, but don't expect anybody to read it, and don't be mad if they don't. They don't have time for it. That's your, I guess, you know, that's your contribution to yourself. Okay, so I took these words to heart. I learned how to think deeply. I learned how to market my ideas better and communicate them clearly up the chain through, you know, the power structure within the university, I guess, which eventually became DARPA program. So I became helpful in having my professor and the startup company we were working with get DARPA funding for various programs. So I learned these basic skills. And then I said, I'm tired of chasing research funding. I hate research funding because I feel like most of the time you're just lying to the NSF or DARPA. And they're not like flat out lies, but they're like quasi lies where you kind of probably know you can't achieve the result that you're offering, but maybe if you got a second phase, you could maybe possibly get the result that they actually want. So it's this continuous leapfrogging of program to program, which I got really sick of. And I said, hey, Dad, what do you do? And he said, I think of things, I design them, and I sell them. And I was like, oh, that's a great idea. Well, how quaint that an engineer actually builds something that people buy. So I said, I want to go work with my dad. And in 2007, I just graduated with my PhD in optics. So I was pivoting into the microwave business, which is not the same. The only thing that's similar, I would say, is that you're still doing Maxwell's equations. Who knows what Maxwell's equations are? Good. Okay, they at least teach E&M still. So RF and microwave are largely governed identically as the math that governs optics. So I was able to at least have that as my bedrock. And then I had to learn more circuit theory stuff. And I still don't know op amps, as Peter points out. So I had a lot of questions, though. And my PhD schooling left me strong enough to where I was asking the right questions at this point. And these were they were the following. First, I had questions about like who's crazy enough to build a handmade electronic part in California. And this was 2007. Things have changed even, you know, since then in a much worse way. Nobody's building handbolt product around here anymore. Or at least most of them are gone. I had a question about why ICs hadn't taken all of our lunch money. At the time that I started, we weren't doing integrated circuits. We were doing the old school hybrid stuff. I couldn't figure out why we could compete against big companies who were more well-funded and had bigger engineering groups. I didn't know what to design. I didn't know how to lead anybody. I didn't know who the customers were. I didn't know anything. And I had this deep fear, what if it doesn't work? What if I screw up? What if I'm the kid who takes over dad's company and just runs it into the ground? And that was a really sobering feeling. It was going to be my fault if I was going to take over Marky Microwave. So I asked my dad all these questions, and he's explaining things to me. And then I had to realize something. Nobody sane would have done what my dad did. Like literally, when you put those things up on the screen, nobody's going to invest in a company where that's your pitch. I'm going to build things by hand in Silicon Valley the old school way. And we're like really, really small. So like anybody could just take our market immediately. But my dad did it. And I realized, you know what? The only reason he could do it is because he was brave, he was determined, and he had to. So that gets me to the final lesson, and it's something that my dad has taught me many times, and it's this. And he'll say it this way. He was not the smartest. He was not the best educated. He was not the best communicating engineer. He kind of followed his gut in a lot of these things. But the thing that he was willing to do compared to his colleagues that could have also formed a Marky Microwave type company doing what he did is he had the willingness to call his own bluff if he ever thought he had a good idea. And it's like, oh yeah, obviously, if you want to do something, you have to do it. It's like the Yoda thing, right? Like, do or do not. There is no try. Okay, yeah, thanks. I get that. Like, I have to do it to do it. But I think what my dad has pointed out to me so many times is so many people who are smarter than you won't do it because they convince themselves it's a bad idea. One of the great entrepreneurial, I guess, truisms that you hear about is most of the best businesses, like the best startups, often sound crazy in a startup environment or in a pitch. Let me put it that way. So Airbnb sounds like a crazy idea before it becomes Airbnb. Oh yeah, people are gonna like just let you into their house and you're gonna stay there. Who would fund that? So that's not to say that Marky Microwave's concept was anything like Airbnb. Like, they couldn't be more different. But the point is, you have to be brave. And so what was it about my dad that made him special? Well, he was an immigrant. He left Hungary when he was, about 12 or 13 years old, with the Russian tanks rolling through Budapest, killing a lot of people. They fled. They fled through Yugoslavia, through to Italy. They eventually took a boat over to Brazil, where he spent all of his teenage years as a jeweler's apprentice. Did not go to school after about the age 12. He ended up coming to America when he was about 20 years old, and he got drafted into Vietnam. And thankfully, he never even had to go to Vietnam. He couldn't speak English barely, which was helpful, I guess. He got discharged. He went to school on the GI Bill. He got his GED. He went to City College of San Francisco. And then he went to Berkeley. Go Bears. Yeah. He was 30 years old when he started his career. Like, he's not supposed to start a company like he did. But he did it because he said, you know what? I don't care if I'm not the smartest, I'm gonna go for it. So I tell myself this a lot, especially when I'm uncertain about, you know, oh, I haven't done that before, like that's a product area that that's really risky. And then I think to myself, you know, am I just talking myself out of a good idea because I'm afraid? Am I afraid of failing? That's something my dad just never seemed to worry about because if he failed in business, what's the worst thing that could happen? If he failed when they were crossing the border under, you know, armed protection, the downside was a lot higher. We have it good. You guys have it good, man. So you can take these risks. So I guess the message is with the call your own bluff idea is that you will come across a lot of engineers who will talk a good game. They'll tell you all the reasons why things won't work. Don't listen to them. Work hard to think about your problems deeply, communicate them properly, and then go for it. I've done that many times. It's worked out really well for me. And I try to pass that on to the other engineers if they're willing to listen. So just a quick snapshot of me before and after. Like I said, when I graduated, I was high ego. I didn't know anything. And I was an arrogant SOB when it came to my technical appreciation. And nowadays, I'm a lot different. I'm a lot more humble because I've been beaten up by Mother Nature many, many times. My dad actually has a sign above his desk that says, "You can't fool Mother Nature." And there's two reasons that's there. First of all, when you do experimentation, like, you know, we tend to in the hardware field, scoreboard, you know, it's like, does it test well? Is it doesn't matter what other people think about it. And that's the other side of it. It doesn't matter what people say if it doesn't work, or if it does work. So that's the little secret for Marky Microwave is, how do we compete with big people and big well-funded companies? We beat them in the spec. We have a better part. It's broader band. It's smaller. It whatever's, you know. So you look at your metrics of how you can make a product and make it good. You maximize the goodness, and then it doesn't matter how big or small you are because they can't beat you. So that's always an important thing, I guess, for technical innovation. a habit that I have, which I recommend all of you start, especially when, you know, after you graduate, is to read daily. And I mean technical reading. Brush up on your technical chops. Learn about adjacent fields of expertise that maybe it's not going to be your main thing, but understand something about it. You should be aware of your boundaries, but you should know a little bit about everything. Let's see. I definitely have a depth of knowledge now. I've been doing this for 12 years and designing a lot of stuff. I'm very comfortable in unbounded problems, and that just takes practice. Right now, you guys are really good at doing problem sets. That will change. You'll get better and better at things that don't have obvious schedules. You'll get better and better at trying to anticipate what the competition's doing so you can, you know, outpace them in a particular technology. That's really what I mean by unbounded. And, you know, finally, I'll just leave you with this. Ask yourself a lot, you know, does my work matter? Because if it matters to you, it will probably matter to other people. And that's a very good way of coming up with good inventions. You know, necessity breeds innovation, right? So, yeah, that's all I have. Any questions? I mean, if the test is life, yes. yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so now I guess I'd like to ask my patent question.
Okay.
Like, especially after, like, knowing that, like, as a small company, if your tech specs are just a deep competition, that's how you win, then why not? What's wrong with patenting that?
Okay. Okay, so in no particular order, why do I not like patents? I'll give you a couple reasons. Well, let me give you the reasons that patents are good. Okay, patents are good if you want to accumulate a portfolio and then sell your business. So if you're trying to package your company to sell the company, patents are great. Plenty of people in Silicon Valley do that. It's a way of living your life, I suppose. We are what's often pejoratively thought of as a lifestyle business, meaning that we're not like trying to be like the wheelers and dealers of, like, you know, some Wall Street hedge fund. We are perfectly happy just being what we are, having people have jobs that where they manufacture things in California. Like, it's perfectly fine to do that. So that doesn't suit our needs. So we wouldn't get a portfolio to sell. Next, it is okay to get patents, in my view, if you are getting it such that you can protect your right to operate. So it's really a defensive place. So it's like, if you think that somebody else might get a patent in a very similar area, it might not be the same thing. But if you're worried about any potential, you know, Venn diagram overlap in the claims of their patent versus yours, you can protect your boundaries in a relatively unassailable way. So it's just like, for example, in theory, now, and this is how it was explained to me by my patent lawyer when I got my one patent. I said, well, you know, if I just sell this, it becomes public domain, and so they can't get a patent on the thing I've already released to the public, right? And he's like, yeah, that's true, technically, but what if they do, and what if it does get issued? Are you going to sue them? Are you going to say that, you know, claim prior art? Do you want to get into litigation with somebody? Well, if you don't want to get into litigation, you don't want that headache, just get the patent now and pee on this bush. That's pretty much what it is. That's my bush. So that's another good reason. Now here are all the bad reasons. You have to work with lawyers. They're very expensive. I think patents generally only help the biggest companies. I think, what did Apple buy Intel for, and how many patents did they get? Like 10,000 patents or something like that? So recently, Intel sold off their modem business to Apple. And modem, right? I think it was the modem. And it's like 10,000. I'm like, 10,000 patents? That's insane. How do they get 10,000 patents? Here's how they get 10,000 patents. The engineers in big companies are given like $5,000 bonuses if they issue a patent. So they're incentivizing people like you eventually to just, you know, run the credit card. Say, oh, I have a relatively dumb idea, but I think I could get patented. Let's type up my disclosure, send it to the legal department. They're streamlined to issue that patent, and they get a patent. I saw some guy who was like bragging he had like 1,000 patents or something like that on LinkedIn. And I was like, I hate this guy so much. So I think that it's a very perverse incentive system. And beyond that, I have read many, many patents. I use them for inspiration because I just figure out a way to not use, I can figure out ways by reading patents in my field to come up with alternative ways to do the same thing. So you just disclose information that you gave away sort of the secret sauce, and now I can use that secret sauce for something else that you didn't think of. So it's hard to write a patent that's so broad that you protect every possible permutation. As a small business, am I really going to sue anybody? Probably not. And I think they're just anti-competitive. I'd rather see an even playing field where everybody fights over it. You see big businesses troll small businesses and block them out of markets primarily because they just have this portfolio that's too intimidating. So that's my reason. Any other questions? Who's going to get into RF now? Nobody. Yeah, do it. It's a good field, man. It's a great field. It's at the nice crossing point of a lot of modern trends, so I would recommend it. 5G is a big deal, and it's going to be a big deal for a long time. Aerospace and defense is one of our biggest application spaces, as is test and measurement. Those are all great fields to be involved in. Don't be persuaded by the big companies across the freeway that that's the only way. There's plenty of other ways to get through. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. That's actually pretty cool. If I was in grad school, I think I'd go into AI, but that's different. Yeah.
Do you think would have been your second best not have the option of like?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about what I would have done if Markey wasn't an option. Well, okay. First of all, I did not intend to ever work with my dad. That was a stated goal of, you know, like, I was like, I'm going to get away from that. I wasn't interested in the handmade product business. Frankly, to this day, I'm not really. Like, everything I do is to avoid all of that. All of my designs are not for hand-built product. So I've tried to transform everything in our portfolio away from it. But if I hadn't, I think probably I would have attempted to go into, like, an R&D group somewhere, but on the industrial side. I got part of the problem with the ivory tower of academics and part of the problem with really advanced research is that most of your time is spent as a PowerPoint engineer, like, or pitching. You're just constantly pitching to live from one funded program to the next. And that's really what a professor's life is. I'm friendly with a lot of professors, and they really complain to me, like, whenever, you know, after a few drinks, they're like, you have the best job, man, because you don't have to worry about who's paying. Like, once you have your cash flow on your ideas as an industrial company, you can keep funding your own ideas. And as a professor, you can't do that. And even if you're working in like an advanced R&D group, let's say at, let's pick like a big defense company, like a Northrop Grumman or a Lockheed Martin. They can't just do what they want either. They have to pitch their ideas to some senior VP maybe, or they have to go find an Air Force DOD guy who's gonna like issue $3 million to go develop some chip or something like that. That's a pretty tough life. It is a tough life. But at the same time, I think for me, the question was asked, what's the most rewarding thing for me? I really like that I now know what is state of the art in my niche, and I like to think of how to push that state of the art farther and then realize it. So, I think that's a really noble way to do engineering. It's very like base level, and I think I would have tried to do that. Yeah, so Markey Microwave was founded in 1991. So my dad had been, it was like the dumbest idea. It was 1991, so that was when the Berlin Wall had fallen, and you know, Russia was, or USSR was done, and there was something called the peace dividend. And the peace dividend was this idea that now that there was no longer the Cold War, we wouldn't have to spend as much money on defense. And my dad's entire business and career had been spent in the Cold War era electronic warfare area, with the cat and mouse game of radars and jammers and countermeasures. And by the way, that's still going on today. So Russia is still a thing, and China is a thing, and the Middle East is a thing. So we're still doing that. Like, it's just way more advanced than it was when he was doing it. And you know, a lot of our products go into systems that, let's say, protect jets when they go into an enemy territory with like radars shining on them. So that's a huge area for us. And so he literally mortgaged the house. He tried to get loans from various investors and or banks, and they said, go away, it's a terrible idea. Why would you start a business in the peace dividend? He even went to, but he did something really, really, really like smart, like in hindsight, it was a genius. He went to his old boss and he said, hire me back, I'll run the mixer business again. Because he had split off and made a rival company that did pretty well, but the company fell apart. And his line was doing okay, but like everything just got canceled. So he was a free agent. He went back to his original company that he'd been competing with for like 5 years. He said, hire me back. And they said, Ference, why would we hire you back? We already have all of your designs. Everything you, like, we just sell what you have, like, we don't need you. And he's like, you're forgetting one thing. If you don't hire me, I'm gonna be the biggest pain in your ass you've ever had. I'm gonna compete with you, and I'm gonna beat you at your own game. I'm gonna beat my own designs. And they said, get out of here. So he formed Marky Microwave. The reason that was smart is that in a downturn, and this is a really important economic concept, in a downturn, it's like the best time almost to do development of a new business. Because a lot of the competition is gonna die. And we saw that in 2009. And so for Marky Microwave, we benefited from the 2009 downturn. My dad benefited from the peace dividend because it burned out a lot of weaker companies. So when he was like, all he needed to do was make his own payroll. So he was cash flow positive within 2 or 3 years. And he didn't really take any loans. He borrowed through gentlemen's agreements with at the time was Hewlett Packard. Now they became Agilent, and now they're called Keysight. But he said, I'll have a loan to buy. So if I make it, I'm gonna buy this piece of equipment from you. And they'd known my dad for 20 years. So you know, he used that personal equity. He went to every customer he had ever known and said, will you buy anything for me? What do you need? I'll do something new you haven't seen before. So it was like, you know, he really hoofed it. I don't know how to get funding. So I'm the wrong person to ask when it comes to venture capital. What I would say is this. Part of Marky Microwave's competitive advantage is that we're privately owned and we have no shareholders besides my family. And that allows me as CEO to never have to please the board of directors. Most CEOs spend at least half their time talking to the board members who are pissed off about shareholder value. I don't deal with that. It's a huge advantage. So it's all about scope. We were never designed to become a unicorn. We never were gonna go public. My parents' stated goal was to feed themselves and put their kids through college. That was it. It was a very modest approach. I think that we live in the Silicon Valley, especially the Stanford distortion field, where it's like, oh, you know, like we're gonna like be the next Google. Who cares? Will that really change your life if you had Mark Zuckerberg money? Like, it won't. Trust me. Like, I'm doing well myself. Like, I have, you know, more now than I did 5 years ago. I don't feel different. I really don't. It's gotten to the point now where I try to define life through other means, like, you know, helping young engineers or something like that. So, I don't know. Peter, am I helping you? So, yeah, funding, I can't help you on that. We started because it was bootstrapped. But thank God, because we never had an outside investor.